original movie, thought it was a load of rubbish and said so at the time, said Pat Carr, production coordinator. Some very high-up people who should have known better were overheard on the set saying that Kurtz and Lucas didn't know what they were doing. The greatest offender was Gil Taylor, director of photography and veteran of the Dambusters. But even Anthony Daniels, a true believer in 3PO as a character, thought the film itself was rubbish. Taylor gave Lucas bright, blazing studio lights instead of the more natural documentary lighting he asked for. The cleaning department kept wiping down the unclean, used universe surfaces. It was all too much for Lucas. There were 1,000 people on the payroll compared to the 15 crew members he had for American Graffiti. He barely talked to the British crew. Kurtz, also not the world's most talkative person, was left to play intermediary. Elstree was a strict union shop. There were mandatory twice-daily tea breaks, taken on the go with tea ladies wheeling carts and assistants delivering mugs to their superiors, and an hour-long lunch. Work would end at 5:30 sharp, unless they were in the middle of a scene, in which case the crew would vote on whether to continue for another 15 minutes. Lucas always pushed for a vote. It always went against him. Alec Guinness was frustrated with the hot, boring, and indecisive shoot. Lucas's bad news, or at least the young director's handling of it, didn't seem to have helped. In the Lucasfilm version of events, Guinness was mollified after Lucas took him out to lunch to explain the importance of Obi-Wan's sacrifice. But on April 12, a week after the crew had returned to England and the other American stars had joined them there, Guinness wrote in his diary that Lucas still hadn't made up his mind to kill him off or not. A bit late for such decisions, he fumed. Harrison Ford referring to me as the Mother Superior doesn't help. 4 days later, I regret having embarked on the film. It's not an acting job. The dialogue, which is lamentable, keeps being changed and only slightly improved. The dialogue changes came courtesy of Willard Hike and Gloria Katz. Lucas had invited the couple to England to give the fourth draft a final polish for a one-off payment of $15,000. Modestly, he estimated they tweaked about 30% of the script. That may be overstating the case. Still, pick a sharp and witty line in Star Wars, particularly one of Han Solo's, and chances are it came from Hike and Katz's typewriter. For example, in the holographic chess scene where 3PO suggests a new strategy to R2, let the Wookiee win. Inside the Death Star, where Luke persuades Han that Leia has more wealth than he can imagine, and Han responds, I don't know, I can imagine quite a bit. Further into the rescue attempt, where Han has a nervous conversation over the intercom with a Death Star commander. We're all fine here, thank you. How are you? When Leia, frustrated with Han and Chewbacca, asks, will someone get this walking carpet out of my way? Ford, then 34, and Fisher, then 19, brought more levity to the proceedings, but they were hardly enamored with the dialogue either. Famously, Ford told Lucas, you can type this shit, but you can't say it. The young trio were shot documentary style, as on American Graffiti. That is, Lucas would let them play the scene as if they were having a normal conversation with no instructions. The director seemed barely present. Ford, almost as famously, said Lucas offered only one of two instructions after a scene. Do it again, only better, or faster and more intense. The biggest smile Fisher got out of Lucas was when she presented him with a Buck Rogers helium pistol at the rap party. Fisher called the cast trick-talking men. She and Ford smoked pot during the shoot until it became clear that Ford's weed was too strong for Fisher. They had a clandestine affair after Ford surprised. The London shoot wrapped in July 1976. Even then, the crowd scenes in the cantina weren't complete. Stuart Freeborn, the British designer and 2001 veteran making the alien costumes, had fallen sick. There was no working shot of R2-D2 rolling down a long desert canyon. The rough cuts Lucas assembled for Laddie were a complete mess, and Lucas acknowledged as much. It's not what I want it to be. Whether Lucas knew it or not, this was a particularly good moment, to be honest. Letty was being hounded at Fox for his championing of The Bluebird, a romantic fantasy film starring Elizabeth Taylor and Jane Fonda, a joint production with a Soviet studio. It tanked at the box office, and Fox, already cash-strapped, was down another $8.5 million. That was exactly Star Wars' budget. If Lucas had not shown a measure of honesty and responsibility by recognizing that Star Wars was in a state of confusion, Letty might have withdrawn his support. As it was, Fox pushed the Star Wars release window from Christmas 1976 to spring 1977. The only bright light for Lucas, perversely, was how badly the British economy was doing. Inflation was soaring and sterling was sinking. In March 1976, the UK government had to go cap in hand to the International Monetary Fund. Investors panicked. By the time Lucas had to pay his contractors, the pound had dropped below $2 for the first time in history. Kurtz got to shave nearly $500,000 off the film's costs. They were now over budget by a mere $600,000. Kurtz and Lucas sat down at one point and made a darkly humorous calculation. Based on their salaries, the pair was earning $1.10 an hour. On the way back to the United States following the London wrap, Lucas took a two-day layover in Alabama to see Spielberg. Close Encounters of the Third Kind had begun shooting with twice Lucas's budget on an enormous set near Mobile, and everyone, Lucas included, assumed it would beat Star Wars. Few people seemed to be screaming for a modern Flash Gordon, but Spielberg's subject, UFOs, they were a national craze. George came back from Star Wars a nervous wreck, Spielberg remembered years later. He didn't feel Star Wars lived up to the vision he'd originally had. He felt he'd just made this little kid's movie. Spielberg's crew would remember Lucas as thin, pale, tired, and hoarse, a man on the edge of a breakdown. The breakdown came after Lucas stopped in L.A. next to check in on ILM. Dykstra had spent fully half his budget building the Dykstra Flex. He had to nail an unprecedented 360 special effects shots by spring. Lucas took a look at the seven shots they had in the can and deemed one to be usable. Tempers flared. Dykstra was fired. On the plane back to SFO, Lucas started feeling chest pains. Driving to San Anselmo, he decided to check himself into Marin General Hospital. Next morning, the doctors told him it wasn't a heart attack. Just exhaustion. A warning shot from his body. My life was collapsing around me, Lucas said. Still, he kept plugging away, maintaining his punishing schedule. He brought Dykstra back but hired a production supervisor to keep ILM in line. No more hippie commune. His first editor had produced a disastrous rough cut. Lucas fired him too and started cutting while he figured out a replacement. The goal was to get a rough cut ready by Thanksgiving. In need of placeholders for the special effects shots and soundtrack, he dug up the World War II dogfight scenes he'd been videotaping and spliced together tracks from his favorite classical LPs. But the production seemed cursed, especially when the trouble-prone Mark Hamill flipped his car trying to make the freeway exit on the way to a recording session. He needed facial reconstruction surgery and fell into a deep depression. Meanwhile, pickup scenes of Luke and his land speeder on Tatooine had to be shot without Hamill, so were filmed at a distance. No one who visited ILM in run-down industrial Van Nuys, in among the chop shops and porn distribution warehouses, could imagine anything great springing from it. "This is where you're shooting the movie?" the then-struggling young actor Rob Lowe, visiting his aunt and uncle at ILM, exclaimed. Lowe wrote that it looked more like a hideout for the Symbionese Liberation Army. There was a terrible smell from the Bantha costume that had been placed atop an elephant for pickup scenes. The Death Star trench was a small number of foam core parts covered in egg cartons and toy pieces. The ILM crew had to keep swapping them around to create the illusion that it was more than a few hundred feet long. Occasionally, exhausted, the technicians took naps in the trench. Many elements were missing right until the last minute. Phil Tippett, a stop-motion animator with friends at ILM, was recruited into the posse in the waning days of Star Wars because Lucas desperately needed anyone who could design and act inside newer, scarier creature costumes for the cantina. The originals were a little too Beatrix Potter for George, Tippett remembers. Then, when Lucas found out Tippett did stop-motion, he asked him to create a chess game with moving monsters for the Millennium Falcon's rec room. Lucas had originally intended to shoot actors in masks as the chess pieces. This was so late in the day, Tippett would end up animating the monster game at night while ILM had its wrap party. Even after ILM wrapped up its work, there was still the long nightmare of sound mixing. Lucas and Kurtz had wanted the movie to employ Sensoround, a bass-heavy sound system used in the 1974 disaster movie Earthquake, and little else since. But Sensoround was owned by Universal, which wanted a whopping $3 million upfront and 10% of all Star Wars revenue. A brash young Dolby sound designer called Stephen Katz met with Lucas and Kurtz and persuaded them that you could get the same effect much more cheaply using the then-novel technology of Dolby six-track stereo. But only some theaters could afford to install the necessary Dolby system, so Lucasfilm's workload was tripled. It had to come up with a six-track mix, a stereo mix, and a mono mix, all by the May 25 deadline. Kurtz booked a mixing theater at Warner Brothers, but his booking was rescinded when the world's hottest action star, Clint Eastwood, needed the theater for his upcoming movie, The Gauntlet. Kurtz scrambled and found a mixing theater at Goldwyn Studios, but only the graveyard shift, 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., was available. It was the worst possible outcome for Lucas and Kurtz, the vampire hours of American Graffiti all over again. Neither could sleep well during the day this time either. One day during the sound mix, Kurtz got a call out of nowhere from Dennis Stanfill, chair of the board at Fox. "The board would like to see the picture," he said. In they trooped, Princess Grace and company, at 8 p.m. that evening to screen a rough cut of Star Wars for the first time. Out they trooped at 10 p.m. without saying a word. "No applause, not even a smile," says Kurtz. "We were really depressed." The last to leave was Stanfill, who lingered to reassure Kurtz on his way out. "Don't worry about them. They don't know anything about movies." It was a sadder, wiser Lucas who sat down with Charlie Lippincott for a post-game interview, intended for a Making of Star Wars book. Neither man expected a huge readership. "It wasn't particularly the movie I set out to make," Lucas said. "Given another 5 years and $8 million, we could get something spectacular." He foresaw a backlash against his comic book movie, and remembered Gene Roddenberry saying it had taken 10 or 15 episodes of Star Trek before the show found its footing. "You have to walk around the world you've created a bit." Lucas dreamed of doing another Star Wars film someday, one closer to the original movie he saw in his mind. The closest he got to that illusion was when he saw the trailer. Cut together really fast, it gave the illusion that this was a movie absolutely jam-packed with spaceships and aliens. There was consolation in the fact that Fox had signed the final contract in August, giving the Star Wars Corporation complete control over any sequels until 1979, in the event that he could scrape together the money to make one. Could this film still work? "Possibly," Lucas conceded glumly. "Maybe the kids will dig it. Maybe it will make as much as the average Disney picture, that is $16 million. That meant Fox would lose a little money when all the marketing and overhead were calculated, but he and Fox might both make some money on the toys. $16 million was a better outcome than anyone around Lucas could imagine, save for Spielberg. Even Marcia believed that the most recent Scorsese movie she helped edit, New York, New York, would do better at the box office. "Nobody's going to take yours seriously," she warned her husband. Marcia had done meticulous editing work on Star Wars as well, but she was displeased with the results. She burst into tears after one screening. "It's the at long last love of science fiction." At long last love was another famous flop from Fox. Luckily, Laddie, who was sitting nearby, did not overhear. Lucas was seeing discouraging signs everywhere, even among his closest friends and strongest supporters. In fall 1976, he and Edward Summers set up the Super Snipe Art Gallery on Manhattan's Upper East Side, a few blocks from the Super Snipe Comic Euphorium, with the idea that the offshoot might morph into a boutique selling Star Wars art. Lucas had a vision of three such boutiques, the others in San Francisco and Beverly Hills, but there seemed to be little interest even in New York. His temper was frayed. Crossing 86th Street with Lucas and Kurtz one day, Summer mentioned that he'd just seen Logan's Run, the big science fiction movie of 1976, set in a silver jumpsuit-wearing future society of hedonistic youths who are not permitted to live past 30. "It's kind of a bubblegum movie," said Summer. Lucas scowled. "Well, I don't think you're going to like Star Wars much," he said. "It's kind of bubblegum." Summer protested. He'd read the script. He was in the posse. Movie theater owners certainly weren't in the posse. Fox had been hoping that theater owners' advance guarantees for Star Wars would reach $10 million. They got to $1.5 million. There were a bunch of great pictures supposedly coming out in May 1977. William Friedkin, who had made The Exorcist and The French Connection, had one of those paranoid 1970s thrillers that seemed to do so well, Sorcerer. There was a World War II picture, A Bridge Too Far, a post-apocalyptic science fiction thriller, Damnation Alley, a buddy movie, Smokey and the Bandit, and Fox's main film of the summer, for which Star Wars was to be a mere curtain raiser, The Other Side of Midnight. Based on a bestseller by Sidney Sheldon, it was a very edgy 1970s kind of romance, its soap opera plot suffused with the hot-button topics of abortion and murder. Fox was so afraid of potential losses from Star Wars that it tried to force the theaters to take the movie if they wanted Other Side of Midnight. And if that didn't work, which it didn't, the company's lawyers were looking into selling the movie as part of a package deal to a company in West Germany, then Hollywood's new favorite tax haven. The price tag Fox lawyers had slapped on Star Wars was less than what it would end up costing the studio, $12 million. Appropriately enough, Fox also made arrangements to dump a movie in West Germany called Fire Sale. And that's the way things might have turned out, but for the fact that Charlie Lippincott had a posse of his own. These days, even Lucasfilm doesn't know how to reach Charlie Lippincott. He's in his happy retirement in a farmhouse in New Hampshire, the state where he grew up, having had his fill of marketing big-budget Hollywood science fiction movies. 30 years in Los Angeles was enough, he says. Lippincott was a science fiction, comic book, and film geek, cut from the same cloth as Lucas. After Lippincott's family moved to Chicago, he watched the Flash Gordon serials projected on the wall of a local library. He was hooked, and followed Flash's exploits in the Chicago Examiner, which his parents wouldn't take for political reasons. He had to sneak the comics page from a girl down the street. A rising star at USC, he was film professor Arthur Knight's assistant and a friend to the younger Lucas. He was the one who brought the French auteur Jean-Luc Godard to campus and made sure Lucas got to sit in on Godard's seminars. After graduating from USC, Lippincott made a name for himself promoting movies at MGM. The guy who hired him, Mike Kaplan, had done the publicity campaign for 2001. Lippincott was eager to learn what had gone wrong in the selling of that movie. He wondered why it hadn't done better. Had Kaplan tried connecting to the fan base at, say, the World Science Fiction Conference? Kaplan sighed. That was just what he'd wanted to do, but the movie wasn't ready in time. So Lippincott knew what he was going to do if he ever got the chance to promote another movie that nerdy. "I was going to build an underground cabal. I would be the one who broke all the barriers." Lippincott had stayed in touch with Lucas since graduation, cutting a promotional reel for THX for the princely sum of $100. By 1975, their paths had dovetailed again. That year, Lippincott had his big break at Universal, devising a tow to promote Steven Spielberg's Jaws, the first movie in history to make more than $100 million at the box office. Lippincott's stock was high, to say the least. Kurtz and Lucas kept their offices at Universal after American Graffiti. They tracked Lippincott down, and Lucas had a 3-hour discussion with him in the lobby of the MCA Black Tower, the intimidating building where Universal's executive offices are located. That weekend, Lippincott read the third draft of the Star Wars end-to-end. He was sold. Here, finally, was a movie for which he could put the Kaplan plan into effect. When he started work on The Star Wars as the film's marketing director in November 1975, Lippincott took an immediate interest in the novelization of the script. Lucas wanted a novel, and his lawyer, Tom Pollock, was about to auction off the rights to New York publishing houses. But Lippincott knew the perfect home for it. Ballantine Books, the most successful publisher of science fiction in the United States. Lippincott took Star Wars to Judy Lynn Del Rey, editor and wife of the legendary science fiction editor Lester Del Rey. Lippincott walked out of that meeting having sold not one but 5 Star Wars titles, 2 novelizations, 2 making of books, and a calendar. Lucas's first idea for the author of the novelization was to tap Don Glut, a member of his old USC cohort. Glut had called Lucas and said, "I heard you're making a movie called Space Wars. Is there anything I can do?" Lucas offered Glut the novel, but said there were a couple of catches. It only paid $5,000. There were no royalties, and Fox was insisting that Lucas's name be on the cover. It was a ghostwriting job. "Thanks," Glut said, "but no thanks." As a plan B, Del Rey recruited a pulp science fiction writer named Alan Dean Foster. He'd enjoyed Foster's novel Ice Rigger and knew that Foster had also written the novelization of Dark Star, not to mention a whopping 10 Star Trek novelizations based on that franchise's animated series. Foster agreed to the terms and had a brief meeting with Lucas at ILM. Making conversation, Foster asked Lucas what he was going to do when all this was over. "I'm going to retire and make small experimental films," Lucas said. Foster was a natural addition to the posse. He too had grown up reading comic books, and that influenced how he wrote. Fast. "I'm watching a movie in my head, really," Foster says. "I write fast because I just describe what I'm seeing." Star Wars was just another job, and he wrote the novelization of the script in less than 2 months using the unreconstructed fourth draft as a basis. He made a few tweaks along the way, starting with that "a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away" thing. He felt another galaxy, another time, worked better. He wrote that Mos Eisley was a wretched collection of villainy and disreputable types. Foster has since been credited with coming up with the name of the Emperor of the Star Wars galaxy, Palpatine, in his prologue. But Foster says he can't remember doing that. The name may well have come from Lucas's notes. The book isn't bad, per se, but it is a relic from a time when Star Wars was still a title to be giggled at. With no one standing over his shoulder reminding him that this was supposed to be utterly divorced from terrestrial reality, Foster threw in a few lines that now sound strange to Star Wars fans, such as, "he wouldn't know a bantha from a panda," and "Luke's mind was as muddy as a pond laced with petroleum." He mentioned one animal specifically so he could throw in one of his favorite comedy lines. "What's a duck?" Luke asks Obi-Wan, a reference to the Marx Brothers movie Coconuts, in which Groucho says viaduct, and Chico mishears it as why-a-duck. After selling the novelization rights to Ballantyne, Lippincott made his portfolios for the crucial December 1975 Fox board meeting that got the film's budget approved. Then it was off to give the same presentation at a Fox sales convention in Los Angeles. 26 in 76. This was when Star Wars was still intended to be one of the 26 movies Fox was going to release in the bicentennial year. The audience of the theater owners didn't care for Star Wars. "I bored the shit out of the old cusses with their big cigars," Lippincott remembers, "but the young people who came with them loved it." He bought the kids dinner and kept in touch. His underground cabal, was just getting started. Another way to hook the kids in advance of the film's release was through comic books. Again, Lippincott made it happen. He did his damnedest to get a meeting at Marvel Comics. Publisher Stan Lee wouldn't take his calls, but Edward Summer got the ball rolling, setting Lippincott up with editor-in-chief Roy Thomas, who had just written a comic book adaptation of Edwin Arnold's 1905 space fantasy, Lieutenant Gulliver Jones, His Vacation. Thomas insisted he would also write the Star Wars adaptation and called a meeting with Stan. The deal Lippincott cut with Marvel was extremely unusual at the time. Normally, a movie would be adapted into one or two issues of a comic book. Lippincott insisted on a minimum of 5 issues, with 2 to be released before the movie. "Fine," said Lee, "but Lucasfilm wouldn't see a dime of royalties on a given issue until they'd sold 100,000 copies. Spider-Man, Marvel's best-selling title, sold 280,000 copies per issue. That didn't faze me one iota," Lippincott says, "because either the comic book was going to work, or screw it." Back at Fox, "they thought I was the biggest fool in the world," he says. Not because of the 100,000 copies clause, but because nobody cared about comics. What did they have to do with bringing in a movie audience? When the first comic book came out and didn't sell its 100,000 copy run, the doubters seemed vindicated. Still, Lippincott doubled down on his strategy. He'd been teaching film part-time at UC San Diego, and one kid in his class had helped found a convention for comics, rather unimaginatively named Comic-Con, a few years earlier. So Lippincott went to San Diego Comic-Con 1976 and prepared to do something the small convention had never seen before: present a panel about an upcoming movie. Today, Comic-Con is packed with Hollywood studios and TV companies touting their wares. It is widely accepted that the convention's early adopter audience can make or break a franchise that has even the slightest relationship to science fiction, superheroes, fantasy, or horror. The studios will closely monitor attendance at the big panels, and woe betide the publicist who can't get a good turnout. When I told Lippincott I was about to visit Comic-Con for the first time, he apologized for what I was about to experience. "What I did led to something I'm appalled at," he said. Lippincott's Comic-Con presentation, however, wasn't anything like what you'd see today. He showed slides. He talked about the story and the characters. There was no teaser, no trailer. The special effects weren't even close to finished. The stars didn't show. There were a couple hundred people in the audience. He sold posters for $1.75 apiece. They didn't exactly fly off the tables at his booth. Still, Lippincott persisted. He went to a science fiction and fantasy society conference in the San Fernando Valley, where he was heckled by one successful author for daring to promote a movie. "The students were all for it," Lippincott recalls. "The older writers thought I was a two-bit salesman." He flew to Kansas in September for the 34th World Science Fiction Convention, in the same hotel where the Republican Party had just that week renominated President Gerald Ford after a bruising primary battle with Governor Ronald Reagan. Lippincott took Mark Hamill and Gary Kurtz and a whole bunch of costumes from the movie along for the ride, although even here he ran into suspicion and misunderstandings. Having never seen a movie promoted like this before, the convention organizers had to be persuaded to let Lippincott show the costumes. Lippincott read up on the history of space fantasy. He talked to fanzines. He studied Star Trek in order to understand what about it had won such devoted fans. He wasn't one himself. His marketing plan, however, called for him to steer deferentially clear of Trekkie circles for fear that they would create a backlash against this upstart movie with a too similar name. Even without targeting that market segment, however, Lippincott watched as the buzz in the science fiction community started to build. Foster's novelization, titled Star Wars, From the Adventures of Luke Skywalker, was published in December 1976, 6 months before the movie was to be released. That was partly a result of the fact that the release date had shifted from Christmas to May, but holding to the novel's original release date was Lippincott's idea. It would get the story out to science fiction fans early, as many as 250,000 of them, the size of the initial print run, and get them all telling their friends. The novelization, with a stunning Macquarie cover, was launched in paperback, hit the bestseller list, and sold out by February. Strangely, Del Rey didn't want to take a chance on a second print run just yet, but Lippincott managed to get it serialized in the Los Angeles Times. The book's success was a tremendous morale booster at ILM, where the special effects team was still scrambling to realize the scenes Foster had so casually described. Lippincott's underground cabal, like the book's mass market audience, was growing as the film's release date of May 25 loomed. The Friday before the Wednesday release, he held a special screening at Fox for the critic from Variety and invited 26 college-age kids to watch it too. The critic accused Lippincott of trying to sway his reaction with a bunch of cheering kids, but he had it all wrong. They were there because they were about to start a phone network, frantically calling other kids around the country and telling them all about this amazing thing they had just seen. Star Wars was only going to open in a mere 32 theaters across America, but thanks to Lippincott's cabal, at least one of these venues was a prime one. The 1,350-seat Coronet in San Francisco, renowned for having the best projection and sound quality in the city. Gary Meyer was the booking agent for both the Coronet and United Artists' secondary theater in the city, the Alexandria. Meyer was so enthused by Lippincott's campaign that over dinner one night, he told Fox's head of distribution all about this hot new movie, Star Wars. The executive was incredulous. The last rumor he'd heard about Star Wars was that the Fox board had fallen asleep watching it and the movie was going to be shelved. He pressed Meyer. He was going to put The Other Side of Midnight in the Coronet and Star Wars in his second-best theater, right? Oh, yes, said Meyer, and promptly booked Star Wars in the Coronet. 11. The First Reel. May 25, 1977, was another gray day in San Francisco, the brief candle of spring snuffed out by the same Pacific fog that made Mark Twain shiver a century earlier. The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco. Nobody knows if Twain actually said that, but every Bay resident knows the truth of it. In the 20-cent Chronicle, the news was just as dismal as the weather. A cargo plane at Oakland Airport had exploded the previous night, leaving two maintenance workers dead and eight injured. Terrorists in the Netherlands were still holding 160 children hostage. The Dow had closed below 1,000, its lowest level in 16 months. Ex-President Nixon was still on TV after four nights and counting of blather with that British interviewer, David Frost. Readers would just as soon forget all about Watergate. They'd also like to forget Vietnam, but the fingerprints of the war were everywhere, even in 1977. The Chronicle reported that the Pentagon was moving a load of Agent Orange across country by train so it could be burned in the Pacific. Harmlessly, officials said. A short blurb noted that the government had just tested the safety of a nuclear fuel shipping cask by running a train into it at 82 miles an hour. Something that wouldn't be known for years, a new round of underground atomic blasts were underway in Nevada on that day. None of these stories got the coveted feature slot on the front page. That was reserved for an article on weddings in Las Vegas. The hot new thing, apparently. A shocking 50,000 couples would get married in Vegas in 1977 alone, it said. They didn't even need a blood test. Most of them will get free pizza, the story said, as well as a roll of nickels, a discount on Reader's Digest, and packets of eucalyptus-scented douche. Nukes, Nixon, terrorists, explosions, chemicals, casino weddings. Who would want to read more about any of that? Readers who made it all the way to page 51 found the day's one piece of cheery news. In a review with the economical four-word headline, Star Wars, Magic Ride, writer John Wasserman, a veteran local character known for reviewing live sex shows, reported on a new work from a local filmmaker that was about to make its debut in the city that morning. A movie judged so unimportant by its studio, It hadn't even received a proper premiere. Wasserman's review was breathless. With the opening today at the coronet of Star Wars, writer-director George Lucas makes a spectacular return to the screen, he wrote. Star Wars was the most exciting picture to be released this year, exciting as theater and exciting as cinema. It is the most visually awesome such work to appear since 2001, A Space Odyssey, yet is intriguingly human in its scope and boundaries. If this wasn't selling it enough, Wasserman described a film as embraceable by children or teenagers as by us older folks. A contemporary Star Trek, a stylish space 1999 that will whisk us on the magic carpet of our imagination. The film even offered a feel-good message. The only audible preaching by Lucas, in a whisper to be sure, suggests that man is man and creatures are creatures, and it doesn't really matter how far forward or back you go to check it out. God is here, the Force. Feelings defeat the calculation. Good conquers evil, but not without sacrifice. And love will keep us together. Star Wars is that rarest of creatures, the work of art with universal, excuse the pun, appeal. There is in all of us the child who dreams of magical beings and fantastical adventures. If Star Wars doesn't garner at least half a dozen Academy Award nominations, I will eat my Wookiee. Flipping past Wasserman's review and puzzling over that bizarre word he just promised to eat, a reader of the Chronicle would have stumbled on a full-page ad for this strange-sounding film. In cheesy Frank Franzetta style, it showed a youth with his shirt open and some kind of sword made of light. A young woman with a gun, and behind them, a spectral apparition with a face that looked like a cross between a samurai, a wolf, and a gas mask. So this was it. The most exciting picture to be released this year. It was playing exclusively at the finest theater in the city. A fine way to escape the fog. The Coronet's first showing was at 10:45 a.m. What did you have to lose except $3? Who wouldn't at least give it a try? Back when Warner Brothers wrested THX 1138 from Lucas's control, Fred Weintraub, the studio's youth expert, gave the young director this advice. If you hook the audience in the first 10 minutes, he said, they'll forgive anything. Those 10 minutes, roughly the length of a film's first reel, could make or break a movie, especially one that required viewers to make a leap of faith, as both THX and Star Wars did. Lucas resented Weintraub, as he resented all studio interference, but he would proceed to follow Weintraub's dictum for the rest of his career. The entire setup of the plot of American Graffiti was conveyed in its first 10 minutes, and more ground was covered in the first 10 minutes of Star Wars than in, well, just about any other movie up until that point. Within this short time frame, the film won over skeptical audiences around the world and earned itself and its creator a place in cinematic history. The first reel of Star Wars was vital, and yet a surprising amount of the credit for it belongs to people whose names are not George Lucas. It's an object lesson in how filmmaking is a fundamentally collaborative endeavor, and the collaboration often extends across decades. Take the first thing the audience at the Coronet would have seen in that first public screening on the morning of May 25, after the Duck Dodgers cartoon. The Fox fanfare. 5 seconds of thumping drums and bright brass in B-flat major. The fanfare was composed way back in 1933 by prolific movie composer Alfred Newman, a friend of Irving Berlin and George Gershwin, and expanded in the 1950s for the launch of CinemaScope, the studio's widescreen movie format. The fanfare had fallen into disuse by 1977, but George Lucas loved Newman's work and asked that it be revived for Star Wars. If you're counting, that's 1 point for Newman and 1 for Lucas. For generations of kids, that fanfare would not mean 20th Century Fox so much as it would mean Star Wars. The part of the fanfare that was extended in the 50s is the bit that plays over the Lucasfilm logo. Many viewers wrongly assume it to be some kind of separate Lucasfilm fanfare. Indeed, while not technically part of the film, the fanfare has become so widely associated with the following 2 hours of entertainment that it was re-recorded by John Williams in 1980 and placed at the beginning of every Star Wars soundtrack album. Years later, when Lucasfilm was sold to Disney, fans realized the Fox fanfare would likely be replaced by When You Wish Upon a Star for Star Wars Episode 7. The internet was inconsolable. After the fanfare dies away, the screen falls silent and black. Up pop 10 simple words, lowercase, in a cool blue. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. These are Lucas's words, as edited by Lucas. The corny addendum, an amazing adventure took place, from the fourth draft, is gone. No title card in the history of cinema has been more quoted. No 10 words are more important. Watching the movie in a theater in Colorado, the beat poet Allen Ginsberg read those 10 words and said aloud to his companion, "Thank goodness, I don't have to worry about it." It was a revolutionary statement. But why? Leave aside the fairy tale cadence, which lulls us into story time. Consider instead that this is exactly what every fantasy epic needs to give you right off the bat. A setting in space and time that says, relax. Don't bother trying to figure out the relationship between what you're about to see and your own earthbound reality, because there isn't one. This isn't Planet of the Apes. The Statue of Liberty isn't going to turn up in a last reel twist. No other movie had ever announced its divorce from our world so explicitly before. With the exception of Star Wars sequels, none would ever be able to do so again without seeming derivative. The perfect simplicity of those 10 words appears to have been hard for a lot of people to understand in the run-up to the movie's release. The words that open Alan Dean Foster's novelization, Another Galaxy, Another Time, aren't quite the same. That might place us in the future, rather than in a story that is safely in some history book. Fox didn't get it at all. Its trailer for Star Wars opened with the words, Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now. The 10 words remain on the screen for exactly 5 seconds. Long enough for the casual viewer to think, isn't this supposed to be a science fiction movie? Aren't they all set in the future? What kind of thing is... Boom! The largest logo you've ever seen fills the screen. Its yellow outlines nudge right up to the top and bottom of the frame. The color, a deliberate contrast with the blue of the preceding 10 words. It is accompanied by a violent orchestral blast in the same key as the fanfare, B-flat major. Both were placed there by Lucas. Neither were his work. Let's take a closer look. The on-screen logo was initially supposed to be the work of a veteran logo designer, Dan Perry. His is the foreshortened, star-filled Star Wars seen on theater marquees and in most print advertising. But the logo that made it into the first reel actually came into being in a far more roundabout way. In late 1976, Fox needed a brochure that was going to be sent to theater owners. To design it, the company turned to an L.A. ad agency called Seiniger Advertising, known for its movie posters. Seiniger gave the job to its newest art director, a 22-year-old named Susie Rice, who had just arrived at the company from a gig at Rolling Stone. Rice found herself at ILM in Van Nuys, getting a tour of spaceship models. She met with Lucas in his office. First, he impressed on Rice how fast this needed to be turned around. Second, he knew he wanted a logo that would intimidate the viewer, something that would rival AT&T. His final direction was that he wanted it to look very fascist, a choice of words that caused Rice no end of headaches when she retells the story. She happened to have been reading a book on German font design. She thought of the concept of uniformity. She chose a modified Helvetica black and set about flattening each letter in a white-on-black outline. At a second meeting with the young art director, Lucas said the result looked like Tar War. So Rice connected the S and the T, the R and the S. After a third meeting, her logo got the okay from Lucas. At a fourth meeting, squeezed in while Lucas was shooting inserts for the cantina scene, when the door was opened for her by the green alien Greedo smoking a cigarette through a straw, The brochure got approved. A couple of days later, Kurtz called Rice to let her know they were going to use her logo in the main titles as well, albeit with a flatter W. Hers had pointy tips. They'd tried Perry's design in the opening credits. Then they tried her design instead, and in Kurtz's words, wow. Wow indeed. The result looks like the world's hottest rock band logo, as if Star Wars might be the next Led Zeppelin rather than a space fantasy film. Instead of putting the logo at the top of the crawl, going in the same direction as the text to come, the layout that was planned for Perry's logo, Rice's design pulls back fast into the stars, as if daring you to give chase. Rice, like a lot of people with tangential involvement with the Star Wars legend, would spend the rest of her career trying to live up to it. Many people have expected me to work a miracle for their project, she says. She has seen her design everywhere, for decades, on t-shirts and caps and lunchboxes and every other single piece of Star Wars merchandise out of the corner of her eye, everywhere she goes. Rice still loves the franchise and has seen every movie. She is sanguine about the fact that she doesn't own it and, as an outside contractor, didn't even get a movie credit. It's what the logo represents, rather than the work itself, that she says she enjoys. The musical contribution, unlike the logo, has been widely credited. Composer John Williams's Star Wars March, not to be confused with the Imperial March, which would debut in 1980, is frequently voted the greatest tune in movie history. Williams had been introduced to Lucas by Spielberg in 1975, prior to the release of Jaws. That movie's ominous theme sealed the deal. Lucas knew that, for his space epic, he wanted something bombastic and brassy in the style of old Hollywood, such as the Flash Gordon serials, which used very romantic 1930s-style scores. The images were going to be wild. The music would have to anchor you in familiar emotions. The temporary track Lucas had assembled contained snatches of English composer Gustav Holst's ominous Mars, Bringer of War, over the start of the film. Lucas's only direction for the main theme was that it contain war drums echoing through the heavens during the opening crawl. Williams obliged and did so much more. Williams wrote the entire score over the course of 2 months, January and February, 1977. The soundtrack was recorded with the London Symphony Orchestra over the course of a few days in March. It was, Lucas later said, the only part of the movie that exceeded his expectations. Jubilant, he played half an hour of it over the phone to Spielberg, who was crushed. Williams still had to score Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and it sounded like Lucas had squeezed the composer's best work out of him. In a sense, he was right. Williams's music is often venerated by fans as the oxygen of Star Wars, in Macquarie collaborator Paul Bateman's phrase. How had Williams been able to create this iconic music so fast? The answer seems to be one part genius, one part pastiche. Williams has often said he owes a debt to the movie composers of the 1930s and 1940s. Specifically, the Star Wars main theme shares its opening notes with the theme from King's Row, the 1942 drama that launched Ronald Reagan's acting career. Few of us hear these influences today, of course. It is impossible to separate the Star Wars theme, or the rest of the soundtrack for that matter, from the visuals of Star Wars. Cut a 30-second TV segment on anything to do with the franchise anywhere in the world, and you're going to get a grab bag of images. Lightsabers, spaceships, creatures, droids, troopers, under the main melody from Williams's March. A supremely self-assured, soaring tune, it can confer a sense of optimism and adventure on any images it overlays, as surely as the Benny Hill Yakety Sax theme can make any video funny. The decision to replace Holst's minor key menace with this major key exuberance is pure Williams. Hands up any listeners not hearing it in their head right now. Next up for the viewer at the coronet, the opening crawl. In 1977, this scrolling text immediately followed the Star Wars logo, without an interposed title. It would not be preceded by Episode 4, A New Hope, until the movie was re-released in 1981. The disconnect between the Star Wars film's titles and their release order often confuses casual viewers, and fans debate to this day whether the numbering system that began in 1980 with Episode 5 reflected the creator's true intent in 1977. George Lucas has claimed in recent years that he really wanted to open the movie with the title Episode 4, but that he either chickened out or Fox wouldn't let me. The written evidence points in the other direction. The shooting script calls the movie Episode 1 of The Adventures of Luke Skywalker. The first drafts of The Empire Strikes Back, written after Lucas had the upper hand over Fox, call that movie Star Wars 2. Gary Kurtz lends credence to Lucas's claim, but insists that the notion was far less precise than the creator remembers. We were toying with the idea of calling it Episode 3 or 4 or 5, as something in the middle, he recalls. We were a bit clouded by the fact that we wanted it to be as much like Flash Gordon as possible. That is, he and Lucas wanted to capture the flavor of encountering a serial halfway through its run, but never got so far as choosing an episode number. Fox hated that idea, Kurtz confirms, and actually, they were right. We thought it would be really clever, but it wasn't that clever at the time. If you go see what's been touted as a new film and it says Episode 3 up there, you'd say, what the hell? Numbering aside, Lucas had hit on something important during all that redrafting. Star Wars remains one of the best examples of the storytelling dictum that it is best to begin in the middle of things. Quite literally so, as it would turn out, Lucas's six-episode saga was the first in world history to open at its precise midpoint. And he did insist that the roll-up remain, in the face of Fox executives who complained that children wouldn't read any kind of scrolling text at the start of a film. About the time they started, Lucas said. Credit for the words that roll up the screen following the Star Wars logo is only one part, Lucas. The other credit goes to the unlikely duo of director Brian De Palma and then-Time movie critic, later filmmaker, Jay Cox. Lucas had screened an unfinished cut for them in spring 1977, along with a house full of other friends. Over dinner afterwards, while Spielberg declared the film was going to be a huge hit, the naturally acerbic De Palma, who had sat in on most of the Star Wars casting sessions, looking for actors for Carrie at the same time, openly mocked Lucas. What's all this force shit? Where's the blood when they shoot people? Perhaps urged on by Marcia, who knew George deeply respected De Palma, Brian later made a peace offering. He offered to rewrite the roll-up. Lucas was crushed, but agreed. The opening crawl had been too wordy in each of its four drafts, and he was down to the wire. His pastiche of lengthy Flash Gordon-style introductions clearly wasn't coming across to viewers. De Palma sat down the next day with Cox at the typewriter. The result? An object lesson in the power of editing. Here's how a line editor like myself might respond to Lucas's version of the crawl. It is a period of civil wars in the galaxy. Redundancy. We've already been told we're in a galaxy far, far away. Also, civil wars, plural, the rest of the crawl only mentions one. A brave alliance of underground freedom fighters has challenged the tyranny and oppression of the awesome Galactic Empire. Too much cheerleading and editorializing. What is this, a propaganda film? Let us decide which side to take. And the word awesome is starting to acquire a different, more positive meaning. Might be best to avoid in this context. Striking from a fortress, hidden among the billion stars of the galaxy. Redundancy again, we already know how huge galaxies are. Also, does it matter that it's a fortress, and might that be too clever a reference to hidden fortress? Rebel spaceships have won their first victory in a battle with the powerful Imperial Starfleet. Isn't it understood the Empire would be more powerful than rebels by definition? The Empire fears that another defeat could bring 1,000 more solar systems into the rebellion, and Imperial control over the galaxy would be lost forever. Why is this all-powerful Empire suddenly on the defensive, Why would 1,000 star systems make a difference if the galaxy has 1 billion of them? And why are you making me do math at the movies? To crush the rebellion once and for all. Redundancy. Things that are crushed tend to stay crushed. The Empire is constructing a sinister new battle station. Name it here, perhaps? Powerful enough to destroy an entire planet. Its completion spells certain doom for the champions of freedom. We haven't been introduced to these champions yet. Perhaps name one of them. How about Princess Leia, whom 3PO will mention in the first few minutes of the film? Also, the movie opens with a ship that has stolen plans to that battle station, on which the whole plot hangs. Explaining that here might help raise the stakes. The De Palma and Cox edit is the crawl that survives to this day. It is a spare and simple 4 sentences, revealing exactly what you need to know, with not a word going to waste. It is a period of civil war. Rebel spaceships, striking from a hidden base, have won their first victory against the evil Galactic Empire. During the battle, rebel spies manage to steal secret plans to the Empire's ultimate weapon, the Death Star, an armored space station with enough power to destroy an entire planet. Pursued by the Empire's sinister agents, Princess Leia races home aboard her starship, custodian of the stolen plans that can save her people and restore freedom to the galaxy. This new ending primes the audience to expect a starship on the screen. But even with that tantalizing prospect, viewers might well be getting antsy by the time they're done reading. Even this pithy version of the crawl takes a precious 1 minute and 20 seconds to climb up the screen and vanish into space. Just 8 minutes left to knock our socks off. To make up for lost time, Lucas has done something very unusual. He has given the film no opening credits. It was an astonishingly self-effacing decision for the time, and one that would later get Lucas into trouble with the Directors Guild and Writers Guild. You would have no idea who directed this movie unless you were to intuit it from Lucasfilm Limited. Yet Lucas was determined that nothing would break the fourth wall of his fairy tale setup. Until 1977, the number of movies without opening credits could be counted on one hand. They were all visionary films of one sort or another. Disney's Fantasia, 1940, was the first, followed by Citizen Kane, 1941, and West Side Story, 1961. More common in the 1970s was the practice of overlaying credits over the opening scene. In his slow-moving classic Once Upon a Time in the West, 1969, Sergio Leone added captioned credits for a record-breaking 15 minutes. Score another point for Lucas for arresting this trend. So the crawl has done its job, at least for the readers in the audience. For the rest, too dazzled by the music, it might as well just be saying, "Awesome, awesome, awesome!" We're expecting the arrival of a starship carrying Princess Leia and the stolen plans. But first, Lucas pans down over one moon, two moons, to the beautiful, luminescent curvature of a desert planet, a point for Ralph McQuarrie's matte painting. And here, our eyes rest for a full 20 seconds, a very, very long break compared with what is to follow. Meanwhile, during the panning shot, the London Symphony Orchestra has taken a much shorter break, a brief moment of pianissimo to acknowledge the beauty of the heavens. Then, as viewers' eyes rest on the desert planet, the orchestra takes a dark turn, spending most of those 20 seconds giving musical warning of some ominous doom just off screen. Finally, there it is, the first special effects shot of the movie and perhaps the most groundbreaking moment in special effects history. The tiny ship Tantive IV being chased by and trading laser fire with a massive Imperial Star Destroyer. We come in low under the hull of the destroyer, which, according to everyone who saw it, seemed to keep going and going and going until we reached its engines. In fact, the Star Destroyer shot lasts just 13 seconds, less than half the length of a TV ad. But by the end of those 13 seconds, the film has effectively established just how powerful and evil the Empire is, and just how overmatched the Rebels are. The best sight gag of the Family Guy Star Wars spoof Blue Harvest imagined the Star Destroyer as the SUV of space, placing a giant Bush Cheney sticker on its rear. ILM recognized that this was by far the most important shot of the film and the greatest possible test of its computer-controlled, jury-rigged Dijkstra Flex camera. If it went wrong, if the Star Destroyer was seen to wobble even slightly, the illusion would be broken, and the audience's suspension of disbelief ruined, possibly for the duration of the film. Like much of Star Wars, this special effects shot teetered on the brink between genius and laughingstock.